As Marius mentioned, I'm going to be talking about catalyzed vacuum decay. So this is work. I sort of started with my supervisor, Pratik, and we're following it up with some collaborators in Brussels, Simone and Alberto. So the general idea is we wanted to ask whether phase transitions in cosmology could be catalyzed by the presence of some defects or impurities. And so that's the question we'll sort of hopefully answer in this talk, and also what the implications of that could be. So the outline is I'm going to just sort of give a general overview of gravitational waves, phase transitions, and also the gravitational wave signal from phase transitions, and then talk about impurity-driven phase transitions or catalyzed transitions and how why you might expect that would be different from the usual case. And then I'll go on to talk about monopoles, magnetic monopoles as impurities. And that's sort of the most natural sort of consideration. I'll hopefully explain why. But this was sort of a bit of a toy setup. And I'll also discuss sort of the algorithm we came up with to actually solve the saddle point equations which govern the transition. And then the last part of the talk will be sort of our follow-up work on how the same effects can apply for the electroweak phase transition in the presence of domain walls. And we'll also talk about the gravitational wave signal in that case and how it might be modified from the usual sort of electroweak phase transition. So there's sort of one of the motivations for studying these kind of things is that the universe prior to the CMB is essentially opaque. We can't detect any photons from any times before the CMB. We expect that at some sort of high scale we had inflation, the universe evolved and underwent at least two phase transitions just in the standard model. There could potentially be others in a dark sector, unfortunately. And so one way that we could potentially observe this part before BBN is by detecting the gravitational wave signal from these phase transitions, if they were first order. So unfortunately, the electroweak and QCD phase transitions in the standard model are not, so they won't produce a gravitational wave signal, but with some minor modifications to the electroweak phase transition, then it could. So that's sort of the broad motivation. And this is sort of a rough picture of what you sort of expect these signals to be. So this is taken from this paper, and these are sort of just representative spectra with some sort of optimistic amplitudes. But you have sort of a peak characteristic peak frequency, which depends on the temperature of the phase transition. So the T reheat here is what the temperature is after the phase transition completes. And you can see for sort of electroweak scale phase transitions, you're right in the band that can be detectable by LISA. And for higher scale phase transitions, you may fall into sort of this mid-band region where there's some proposed experiments. And even higher, it could be observable with LIGO, although...
What are the strength of the phase transition to get such large signals?
Yeah, I don't think this is realistic models. This was just sort of... it has to be generally, I think, so for the signals we'll show later, for the electroweak phase transition, they're more sort of like around the 10 to the minus 12 level. But this is just sort of to characterize sort of what the frequency is. So the frequency scales linearly with the temperature. And you sort of have this, triangle kind of shape where you have a sharp peak. The amplitudes here are not. I think this sort of peak spectrum is specific to phase transitions. So I think
the question is.
Would something else give you a signal in this region, or
it's not like you have a precision prediction of that shape from phase transition. It's kind of like that, right?
Right.
Maybe there is something else, like unresolved binaries and stuff like that.
Yeah. So you could detect. So. You may expect a signal from binary mergers, also I guess cosmic strings and other things could also give you a signal there. I'm not 100% sure how easy it is to disentangle the different spectra. Okay, so the basic picture of a phase transition is that we have, or a first order phase transition, is we have some potential with two minima. We start in the false vacuum, so the local minimum, which is not the global minimum of the potential, and then we sort of tunnel to the ground state. And so for it to be first order, there needs to be a barrier between the two minima, otherwise the field can just classically evolve. So we need that in order to get a first order phase transition and then a gravitational wave signal. And the way this tunneling process works is we sort of start in the, if this box is the universe, we start in the homogeneous false vacuum everywhere state. We tunnel these bubbles of the true vacuum, and then because they're at a lower point in the potential inside the bubble, these bubbles will start to expand, and eventually you'll end up in the true vacuum. And this rate, gamma, which is sort of the main quantity that we're sort of will be modified with the impurity case, is the number of bubbles nucleated per unit volume per unit time. And it goes as some prefactor, which we'll just approximate with some dimensional scale of the problem, and then it's exponentially suppressed by this bounce action, B. And so the B is sort of the main quantity that we're going to try and compute in the impurity-driven case. There's also, in a sort of cosmological context, there's also a bound that you can place on these models just by the fact that the false vacuum is also expanding just due to the Hubble expansion. And you say that the phase transition completes when this rate of bubble nucleation is greater than Hubble, where the Hubble has some radiation component and then also a contribution from a cosmological constant. So just by requiring that the phase transition complete, you can already sort of rule out some models. Okay. And this requirement roughly translates into a bound on the bounce action. So it has to be about 140 if you put in the numbers for phase transition, which happens at the electroweak scale. So the phase transition is still exponentially suppressed, but there is some critical value. And so in order to extract the gravitational wave signal, is to sort of a first approximation, the two main parameters which you care about are this beta, which is the inverse time scale of the problem. And for a relatively fast phase transition, it's the slope of the bounce action B here as a function of temperature as it crosses this critical value. So once it reaches 140, this slope gives you the this parameter beta, which sets the frequency and also the amplitude. And the other one is the amount of energy released as a proportion of the total energy. So if we assume we're in a radiation-dominated universe, it's the difference in the height of these two potentials divided by the radiation energy density. So, for example, and generally what you assume is that as the temperature decreases, the thermal corrections of the potential get smaller and you have a deeper minimum, so you'd expect more energy to be released.
What's the equation for the beta parameter? So why is the slope of the bounce action relevant?
Yeah, so this condition is kind of like when you expect order one bubble to be nucleated per Hubble patch. And then if this is decreasing relatively quickly, then it's sort of like one E-folding after it's. So after that time, you expect many bubbles to be nucleated very rapidly. So this is roughly the time scale at which the phase transition goes from being one bubble to many bubbles. So it's kind of like if you say B is a function of temperature, and then you have some critical value plus the first term in a Taylor expansion, that's what beta is. Okay, and so the signal that you get in this case goes as H over this ratio of H and beta. So H star is the Hubble parameter when the critical condition is met. and goes like alpha squared for alpha less than one. And the frequency at the peak goes like beta and then redshifted to today. So beta basically sets the frequency, and also for larger beta, the amplitude is smaller. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about catalyzed phase transitions. So these, part of the motivation for this was that catalyzed phase transitions happen sort of very regularly in everyday systems. So one nice example from particle physics is that of a bubble chamber, where you have a liquid which is in a supercooled state. So the preferred phase is a gas. And then as particles enter the chamber, the energy they deposit into the liquid triggers the phase transition. And so you get these bubbles form along the particle tracks, but also things like formation of clouds and things like that, water condenses around impurities or seeds. So this is kind of similar to the effect that we want to try and model in cosmology, because in cosmology you usually assume this homogeneous state where we're just in the false vacuum everywhere. So the picture, the rough picture looks something like this, where we have our sort of false vacuum background, but then have some impurities. And then these impurities tunnel to bubbles of true vacuum in sort of a similar way. And then the rate here will now depend on the number density n, and there'll be some different bounce action. And if this bounce action is sort of order one smaller than the false vacuum bounce action, so this false, that FV subscript means tunneling from the homogeneous case, then because of the exponential dependence, we can expect this rate to be significantly smaller than the false vacuum one. So even for a small number of impurities, this rate can, this effect can still dominate. And then we have the sort of same condition, but with a new rate for the phase transition to actually complete. And also we have a sort of new sort of time scale in the problem. So before, this parameter beta was set by how fast you're nucleating bubbles, so the which depended on the bounce action as a function of temperature. But now, if we say, if for example, take the limiting case where there's very few impurities, but they sort of decay very quickly, then this rate beta will just be given by the velocity of the bubble walls divided by their separation. So the time scale would just be how long does it take for one bubble to actually meet the other bubble. We can have a sort of different, you can already see how we might have a different gravitational wave signal just from this. Okay, so that brings us on to the first sort of work that we did on monopole tunneling. So this was done with my supervisor, Pratik. And so the monopoles are sort of kind of the most sort of intuitive case as to why you might, intuitive candidate for an impurity which could trigger a phase transition. So first, just going to go through how we calculate beta in the false vacuum case. So beta is the Euclidean action evaluated on the bounce solution minus just the false vacuum case. And this bounce solution, so in the zero temperature limit, which is what we're considering here, at large Euclidean time asymptotes to the false vacuum solution for this whole thing to be finite. And then at Euclidean time equals to zero, describes the bubble profile. The solution interpolates between the two. And the bubble profile looks something like this, has a characteristic radius. And then inside that, there's a region of the true vacuum, and then it sort of interpolates between that and the false vacuum. And to make some sort of qualitative arguments, we can study this in the thin wall regime, which is not always valid, but basically it's just approximating the bounce solution as essentially a step function where inside we have the true vacuum, outside's the false vacuum. And then when you plot the energy of a bubble as a function of the radius, it looks something like this. So R equals to zero is just a bubble of zero size, so just the false vacuum. And then you have some barrier and then some critical bubble size out here. And the tunneling process is kind of like tunneling from here to here. Okay, so now we'll turn to magnetic monopoles. So just quickly, we're talking about an SU2 gauge group, which is broken to U1 by a triplet scalar. And this sort of, the vacuum is described by this equation, so it describes a two-sphere. And we can have sort of topologically distinct maps from the spatial two-sphere at infinity to the vacuum two-sphere. And so this is actually just the U1 case. I've just drawn a circle. So we can have this sort of topologically trivial map where every spatial point described by these two angles is mapped to a single point in the vacuum manifold. Or we can have sort of a one-to-one map where every point on in space is mapped to a separate point in the field space. And so that's the case for the monopole. The monopole is sort of this map. And so you can see that from this equation. So you have phi A, that's the field space direction, is proportional to r hat A, the spatial orientation. And we also have the gauge field. The profile looks like this, which will sort of be in the background for most of the talk. I'll be focusing on the scalar field because that's what drives the phase transition dynamics. But the gauge field is always there. And for this map to be continuous at the origin, because so phi is pointing in a different direction in every orientation, at r equals to zero, the only way for this to be continuous is that this function h, which describes the monopole profile, vanishes at the origin. So if we have a potential which looks something like this, where the sort of broken vacuum, which is our assumed initial state, is actually the false vacuum of the potential, there's some barrier, and the true vacuum is at zero, then the monopole solution, which will look something like this, has some region. It's forced to be zero at the origin, so it already has a region of the true vacuum, so in the interior of the monopole. And the monopole radius is set by 1 on the gauge coupling times V, so sort of the analog of the W mass.
That looks like, in the third universe, like, how does the monopole form in this case?
Yeah, so you'd have to have a pretty weird setup for this specific. This case is sort of not particularly phenomenologically motivated. It's kind of a toy setup. But you would need to have something where, I guess, you have the unbroken phase preferred at high temperatures. Then you go to the broken phase, form some monopoles due to the Kibble mechanism, and then have some temperature corrections would lift the vacuum again. I'm not sure how realistic that is, to be honest, but we're sort of considering this toy setup, and then the domain wall case we consider after would be the more realistic case.
What is the more realistic case?
The domain walls that we'll talk about later. Oh. But you could also have, So the more realistic case would be if you have two scalar fields, which is the same as the domain wall case, and one of them forms a defect, and the point at the center of that defect won't actually be exactly in the true vacuum, but it will be closer, and then you're tunneling in the other direction, and that's assisted by the. So here it's just we're doing one scalar field, and we have a specific construction where the true vacuum is the core of it.
How easy it is to get to that state when you have two scalars to do that? I guess we'll talk about it later. I don't want to.
I'll address it later. There's a for this to have it look like this. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You also need to have a dimension 6 term in the potential to get this barrier, and they have to all be of the same order. So there's other issues. But this is sort of just a toy model to quantify the effect. Okay, so the monopole tunneling now, we have some sort of stable bubble. If we plot the same picture of as energy as a function of the radius, we have some new minimum. So the monopole is kind of like a stable small bubble of the true vacuum. And so this tunneling process goes from now from a small radius to a larger one. So you might just, this is sort of why I said it's the sort of natural candidate for something which could trigger a phase transition, because you would just expect that tunneling from a small bubble to a large bubble is easier than tunneling from a bubble of zero size, which is the phosphate case. The bound solution looks somewhat different. So it's kind of in by analogy to the false vacuum case. At large tau, we asymptote to the monopole solution instead of the homogeneous false vacuum, and then expand to a larger bubble at tau equals to zero. And we have some new bounce, which is this what we call the monopole bounce, which is this expansion minus the just the monopole solution itself. In comparison to this, where you're sort of deforming the whole solution. In the false vacuum case, but
are the monopoles? Do the monopoles have excited states, or is it because I guess this is like a Rossi configuration or something? Do they have excited states?
I'm not too sure.
You can have various mappings, right? It's like
yeah, but that's
you can have a high number, right?
Yeah, you can have higher charge.
That's high energy, right? If it's
that would be exciting, yeah.
Yeah, but
yeah, because the reason that I'm asking is that this is a different context, but I'm in just normal materials, in just normal whatever dielectrics. So electrons tunnel in impurities due to impurities, but the main mechanism for tunneling is not tunneling from the electron impurity ground state into something, is tunneling from excited states of the electron into something, and that's called the full frame effect.
Okay.
It's measured. So I was wondering if there's something similar here, because you're getting like some help from the fact that the electron is thermally excited, and then you tunnel, and then the difference is several magnitude in the rate, as opposed to computing tunneling from the ground state of the impurity. So that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, I guess if there was an excited state, so this you just, I mean, I don't know if like what the excited states of a monopole would look like or if they're stable.
They don't have to be stable. I mean, in normal materials, like the excited.
Well, I mean, if you were to calculate this tunneling for an excited monopole state, the lifetime, the rate it takes to decay by a tunneling has to be smaller than the.
Electron is electron in a higher energy state. It's not this internal structure is excited, right?
Yeah, of course, but
so meaning that it has more kinetic energies than electron.
Yeah, of course, it's an maybe three dimensional, but I mean, I would find there's something similar.
Well, it would be a faster moving monopole,
I guess.
That's what it would be.
Yeah, but that's just center of mass.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe higher charge monopoles, but again, okay, but yeah, so because we're asymptoting here to the sort of monopole profile, which is already a function of R, this sort of breaks some of the symmetry of the solution. So for the false vacuum case, you can show, given some sort of very mild assumptions on the potential, that the solution depends only on rho, which is this combination of R and tau. And so the equation just becomes an ODE, which you can solve by shooting methods. But because the monopole solution is a function of R, and there's sort of explicit factors R in this equation of motion, also for the equation of motion for the gauge field, you don't have this symmetry, so you have to solve the profiles as a function of both R and the Euclidean time. This is a more difficult problem.
If you end up going to that side, like you know, that one side, so it's some H mod.
Yeah, MB, sorry, is the monopole bounce. So that's this configuration which goes from the monopole solution to the critical bubble and then back to the monopole solution.
And the U, does it change or not?
U also changes, yes.
Okay. That's one. I assume it's a U H.
Oh, yeah, that's a typo, sorry. That should be a U.
Yeah, the U will be different too.
Yes, yeah. U also changes, yeah. Yeah, just to sort of not fill the slide with equations, I've neglected the U. But the, the same stories. Okay, so the I'm now going to go through the procedure that we actually came up with to calculate this, and it sort of depends on the fact that the bound solution that we're looking for is a saddle point of the action, so it has a negative direction because the bubble wants to spontaneously expand, and sort of the procedure is that we want to start with a guess for the solution and then improve this guess using something like a gradient descent method, which is given by this. So you have start with some h and u, the two profiles, and then update it to a new profile, which is given by some step size times the derivative of the action with respect to the field. But this process minimizes the action. And so we have something, so the goal is something like this, where we start with the guess and we get it closer to this red star, which is the saddle point. So this is sort of a exam, this is just a function of two variables with a saddle point, but we're in reality, this each point on here is an entire field configuration.
It's like, so here, like you're solving an H with one component or three components. What about you?
You mean like each component of the, so it's saying it has the same topology, it's just expanding.
And that, so is there like an argument for like why that is the only thing relevant?
I think you could say expanded in angular modes as well, but I would expect that like some YLMs, I would expect that they would always give you a larger contribution if it's twisting as well as expanding.
No, you have your two indices.
Yeah.
Because like the U outside is only like the U1, right? But like inside the U, in principle, has all three as your two indices or not?
No, it's still, the solution still looks like this. And this just so it points in the same direction, like on any orientation, it's always pointing in the same direction in field space, but the profile is changing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But like inside your bubble, it's the SU2 invariant.
Right.
So should I expect the profile to also have the field component for you and the SU2 component, the other SU2 components or not?
Oh, you mean for the gauge field?
Yeah.
I don't know. So this again is also a profile for all the SU2 components.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you would expect it to change.
Yeah.
Okay. Just both U and H are expanding.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is a goal. The problem is that we're not actually looking for a minimum, we're looking for a saddle point. So if we start with some guess, it's just going to run down and find one of the minima. It's just going to decrease the action, so fall off this ridge, basically. What we use to sort of overcome this is what's known as the mountain pass theorem, which basically says that we have some functional I of f, and we have a local minimum, which is like this point here, and then another point F1, which is at a lower action. Then if we consider all possible paths between these two, the one that crosses this ridge at the lowest point, which is what this means basically, will cross through the saddle point. So it's kind of like if you're sort of climbing out of this, it's going to cross this hill at some point, and the one that crosses it at the lowest point on the hill, this point is guaranteed to be a saddle. And so the bounce action that we're looking for satisfies all the conditions for the theorem. We have a minimum, local minimum, which is the monopole solution, and we can construct some very large bubble, which has a big region of the true vacuum, which has a lower action than this one. And then we just need to consider all paths between here, the two, and deform them in such a way that we eventually get to the saddle. Yeah, so we solve for the monopole solutions, we can construct this large bubble solution to find one where the action is negative. And then if we deform these paths, it'll eventually saturate a value where we're at the saddle point. So this is basically what I just described. We start with H alpha. So alpha parameterizes the direction along the path. So H of zero is the monopole solution. H sub one is this supercritical solution. And then we pick the point along the path which maximizes the action. And then we do the gradient descent with respect to that. Also, there should be the gauge field as well. And so that shifts these points. But what can happen is if this point here starts to move down the hill, so it starts to run away to one of the minima, if we deform all the whole path in a continuous way and then constantly pick the new point, which is maximized along the ridge, then that sort of factors out this negative mode and we get something which looks like this and converges. So that's the sort of idea. This is how it works. So this is the action, the highest action along the path as the sort of algorithm proceeds, and you can see it starts very high and then sort of saturates at a point which we expect is the saddle point. To sort of cross-check this, we also calculated this sort of cost function, which is basically the equation of motion at each point squared, and then summed over all the points in R and tau space that we sampled. And you'd expect it to go to zero also because the equations of motions are satisfied at the saddle point. And as you can see, it does. These sort of bumps are when there's a new point which maximizes the action along the path. As it sort of switches, one starts to fall off the hill and then it switches to a new one. Okay. So now to go to the results. So this is the scalar potential we consider. We have some coupling lambda, which sets the overall height of the potential. Epsilon is the difference, normalized to v to the fourth between the two vacua. And yeah, that's it. And as I think you said before, we had to add this h to the sixth term in order to get this structure. And it's, as you can see, it's basically the same order as the other terms. Anyway, the results look like this. So this is for fixed lambda, this scale of the potential. We also have the gauge coupling, which sets the monopole radius. And we're varying epsilon in this plot. As you can see, the difference between the sort of two actions is of order 100. And then a similar thing here, where we're varying the gauge coupling, keeping these two parameters fixed. So the scale of potential looks the same, which means the false vacuum process looks the same. But as you go to smaller gauge coupling, the monopole radius is larger, and eventually it becomes a critical size as you go take G to Z. And just to give you an idea of the numbers, the ratio of the two the exponential suppressions is very large for all of the points in this plot. So it just shows like how large the effect can be. Again, it's because everything appears in the exponent here. And so you can sort of get some rough idea of the conditions. So remember, the actual tunneling rate depends on the number density of monopoles. So the condition for it to dominate is that it should be larger than V cubed, and then this ratio of the two exponents. And then, if we assume that at some higher scale T, we have the monopoles produced, then the number density at T equals to V, we have one monopole per Hubble, and then we go to a lower temperature where this process is taking place, the monopoles will essentially always dominate. That's sort of the end of this section on the monopole case. Now go on to considering the domain wall case for the electroweak phase transition, which is work still in progress. And so this sort of goes back to Mina's question before. This is sort of the more motivated scenario. So we're considering just the standard model and adding a scalar singlet with a Z2 symmetry. And so we have a two-step phase transition where high temperatures were at the origin. The S phase transition, we break the Z2 symmetry first, which forms the domain walls. And then there's a first order phase transition to the electroweak vacuum. And in this case, the domain walls sort of interpolate between, at the center of the domain wall, S vanishes, so it interpolates between here and here. And so this point is not actually at the true vacuum of the potential, but it's closer to it. So the domain wall, the center of the domain wall is sort of tunneling in this direction as opposed to this direction, what gives the enhancement.
What are you assuming about the hierarchy of masses between H and S?
Yeah, they're the same order. So the benchmark points we consider at mass is about 250 GeV for S. The reason sort of why I chose that value is that for this model, if the scalar mass is larger than half the Higgs, twice the Higgs mass, sorry, then it's basically impossible to, or very difficult to detect the colliders. So the phase transition signal is the only way you can sort of see the model. And it's also, so it's used as a benchmark model for some of the like gravitational waves.
How close do they have to be to get the effect you want? What is the range of, when does this usually happen?
So,
how close do they have to be? I'm trying to understand if there's any tuning parameters. That's what I'm getting at with this. How special is this? Because what you wrote down is not special for sure. You can have to scale it.
Yeah, so let me think. I think they have to be roughly the same order to have a first order phase transition at all. I'm not 100% sure on the details.
Another maybe related question. You have Z2 quality on this side. What part of the potential ends up getting mussed up if I make the cutoff scale much less than mass Planck?
The domain walls don't survive for long enough.
Okay.
So if you don't have an exact Z2 symmetry, one of the two, so the domain wall is going between minus Vs and Vs. They're the two minima of the potential. If the Z2 symmetry is not exact, then one of them will actually be at a higher point, and that puts some pressure, that generates a pressure on the domain wall, which will cause the regions of the higher vacuum to collapse. So you need them to survive for long enough to still be around at the electroweak phase transition in order to catalyze this effect. Otherwise, all the domain walls will have disappeared. You'll just be in the whichever is the lower vacuum, and then you just have the usual. So it's a fairly strong requirement. Okay. So again, we have a sort of a similar thing where we've now broken the symmetry one direction. So Z here is the direction transverse to the domain wall, and rho is along the domain wall. We're in the high temperature limit now, so we don't have to worry about the Euclidean time. The O3 solution is the false vacuum process is dominant. And we have this sort of initial conditions where boundary conditions where H in the false vacuum is zero, where S is the domain wall profile. And the profile looks something like this. So this is from an earlier paper, but the yellow shading is the S profile, so the domain wall. The mod S on Vs is one in this core of the domain wall. Okay, and then so this out here is just the domain wall solution, and then these gray contours are the Higgs profile. So you have sort of an elliptical bubble of the Higgs, and then for the scalar S, it looks like a domain wall which is sort of bulging at the center here.
Just one quick question. So the direction
transverse along the domain while it's rho. But
yeah.
Assuming that it's like a cylinder, like what's up with the 1 over rho d phi d rho? It's not a planar domain wall?
No, it is a planar.
So what's the direction along the plane?
Rho. Rho is this.
If it's planar, is there like a 1 over r contribution? That looks like cylindrical coordinates.
Yeah, so this is cylindrical coordinates.
It's not an infinite plane.
No, it's like a disk like this.
Yeah, I'm just confused.
Wow. So yeah, this rho is a plane, and then z is the transverse direction.
I think Matt is asking about the xy. Why is it so?
Oh, well, I mean, if you take x and y can go up to infinity, but I guess, so the bubble nucleated has the shape of a disk, but the domain wall is infinite in extent. So the domain wall is a plane, but the bubble is circular, or elliptical, the disk in the rho direction.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so this is a comparison. I should say this figure was taken from this earlier work, and in this work they did the same thing, keeping only the t-squared corrections to the potential and using a sort of mode expansion in the z direction to calculate this. And this orange, yellow, and blue curve are their results. And so for this point in the parameter space, this curve up here is the homogeneous tunneling. And so they were able to get results which clearly show that the domain wall catalyzed effect dominates, but the calculation sort of breaks down in the region where you want to actually calculate, for example, this parameter beta, which sets the gravitational wave signal. And then these diamonds here, this red curve, are the results from the mountain pass theorem, which sort of allowed us to interpolate between the full region, and so we can sort of extract the parameters which actually determine the gravitational waves.
What is MKQ here?
Yeah, so they do a expansion in what they call KK mode, so basically eigenmodes in the z direction, and this is just how many terms that they're including in this expansion. So it's sort of like you integrate out the z direction, and then you get some EFT of all the coefficients, and then you solve the tunneling process for them. But it also means that we can, so instead of just using the T squared corrections, using this algorithm again, we can keep the full numerical potential. And this is a comparison to this homogeneous tunneling process for these points. Here, and this is the mountain pass theorem result. So you can see there's sort of this is sort of the generic expectation for what the catalyzing effect would be. Is basically that first of all the phase transition happens faster. In this case, there will be a classical instability of the domain walls at some point here, although the algorithm sort of doesn't. Makes it hard, it doesn't work so well when you get close to this point. And so you can see this slope here will be larger. So we're gonna have a reduced gravitational wave signal, which is also shifted to higher frequency. And then the second sort of thing which can happen is, for the separate parameter point where the false vacuum process is very large, so you would usually conclude that the phase transition in this for this region of parameter space was ruled out. Because of the effect of the domain walls, it can now complete. So this black line is the condition for the phase transition to complete in the domain wall case. So it's sort of this point is sort of it's barely able to finish with the domain wall catalyzed effects. the false vacuum process is ruled out. So there's a sort of the two effects. You can either have a phase transition which is already allowed but happens much quicker because of the catalyzing, or the phase transition might naively be ruled out unless you include this. And the expectation.
What is the roughly like the value of TC in this case?
It's like the electroweak scale. It's like 110 GeV.
So how good is the assumption that like I already have a stationary domain want to start with?
So that depends on the sort of quality of the Z2. You mean that the domain walls have collided?
They have collided, sorry. Like they are still oscillating, right? Or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Is it only like one state that is left over for the S here?
But potentially not, actually. I don't know. But we're assuming it's the ground state.
Okay.
So, and this sort of shows the gravitational wave signal in the various cases. So, this is the black line, so this is this point here. The black line is the homogeneous process in the gravitational wave signal we expect. The blue line is the catalyzed phase transition. So it has a smaller amplitude, first of all, because the tunneling is happening closer to TC, which means that the difference between the heights of the two minima of the potential is smaller. And also this parameter beta was larger, which also reduces the amplitude. This could be improved somewhat if you assume that the domain walls are very far apart. And then so this beta is set not by how fast the bounce action is changing, but how long it takes the bubbles to reach each other on separate domain walls. And then you get some enhancement of the signal relative to this case, and the peak is shifted to lower frequencies. And then this red line is the new, this point here, which was ruled out, so there's no line for the homogeneous case. But then this phase transition is strongly supercooled, so depending on the parameters, it can sometimes be larger than false vacuum prediction. So this is sort of a summary of the different effects you can have. You have a phase transition which happens much quicker, so you have a lower signal. This lower signal could be enhanced somewhat if the impurities are far apart, and then you can have new points which may have different features which were not previously allowed if you just consider the homogeneous process. Okay, that brings me to the end. So just to quickly summarize, so gravitational waves from phase transitions could offer us sort of a new way to study directly early universe cosmology. And we usually assume that the phase transitions proceed from a homogeneous background, but if we sort of look at examples from the world around us, that's often or almost never the case. So we wanted to look at what could act to seed impurities and what the implications could be. And so topological defects are one way that this could happen. And it sort of modifies the gravitational wave signal in these sort of three ways. Thanks.
This is going to be awesome. I'm going to sound really old. So 10 years ago, roughly, for an entirely different focus, not necessarily to study stochastic gravitational waves, but more in the context of like the string landscape, a lot of the same themes emerged. And I was just curious, like this thing of bubbles on the mean walls were called barnacles.
Okay.
There were papers written about and the signatures in the CMB that they might yield, and then monopole catalyzed decay was like D0 brains seeding flux transitions, and there were all sorts of things about domain walls coming apart, things like that.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity, like, because there might be an interesting set of ideas to plumb and apply in these other areas, is there any connection, or do the people in your industry know about this stuff, or...
I don't personally.
The citation chain would be like totally different.
No, I've not heard about these things. But when you say that the bubbles are nucleated on the domain walls, is it this picture or there's a separate phase transition which just happens on the domain wall?
No, it's the same thing.
Okay.
Just by your name.
Okay.
And then the other question I had is, in that same time period, there was a postdoc in my group, Caroline, right, who wrote this Cosmo transitions code.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare against that, or are you aware of that?
I think
it's a slightly different method, and I'd be really curious to see how your...
Yeah, the Cosmo transitions, these homogeneous ones are done with, I think, the Cosmo transitions, but I didn't actually do them myself.
Okay.
But I think that uses the shooting method, which is you need it to be a function of one variable for that to work. So it wouldn't.
So it can be, but maybe not as a function.
No, I mean one coordinate.
Yeah.
You can do multiple fields, but you need to sort of have a way to vary. Basically, the way it works is you have the boundary condition that the derivative vanishes at the origin, but the actual field value can vary. And so you sort of pick a guess and then you see whether it asymptotes to the false vacuum or not, and then update that guess. But you can't do that when you have two variables because you would need to guess the entire function.
Yeah, got it. No. Okay, yeah, thanks for bringing up the details. That's interesting.
Other questions? I don't know if people from Zoom can hear us.
Oh, yeah.